Hello, and thank you for joining me for today's episode of Big Ideas in Eating Disorders. In this series, we hear from people in the field of eating disorders who share with us their personal and professional journeys, experiences, reflections, and big ideas that never quite get represented in this way in the standard academic publications and conferences. I'm Kathy Pike, clinical psychologist and professor at Columbia University, your host of Big Ideas in Eating Disorders. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Carolyn Becker. Dr. Becker is a clinical psychologist. She's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Trinity University. She specializes in the implementation of scientifically supported interventions in clinical and real-world settings, has lots of experience across a range of specific areas within eating disorders that we'll learn more about, and would like to begin with a warm welcome. Thanks, Carolyn, for joining us. And maybe you can start with how it all started. When did you first have the idea that you were going to become a clinical psychologist?
Oh, wow. Okay. Wasn't expecting that question. That one goes all the way back to my undergraduate days. So I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore College and taking the classes that interested me. I always think it's a little ironic that I constantly advise students not to do a double major. And I did one, not because I had this glorious idea of a double major, just because I took everything that interested me, and that was mostly in psychology and then in sociology, anthropology. And as a result, that was where I majored. And I was particularly interested in issues around women, the intersection of biology, psychology, and mental health. And over time, I found that I could sort of wrap all the things I was interested up in like this one area, which was eating disorders. I was never bored when I was thinking about that. That's sort of a big issue for me, as I get bored easily. And so it was like clinical psychology, I think, appealed to me because there were so many different things I could be doing.
In your undergraduate education, did you have a course in eating disorders, or were you learning about eating disorders from your peer group? Where did eating disorders first hit your radar?
I think it hit my radar in psychopathology class. Well, I cheated. So one of the things at Swarthmore College is that they have both an honors track where they have these 8-credit-hour courses, and they have traditional 4-credit-hour courses. And I took the traditional 4-credit-hour course in psychopathology. And I wasn't honors because I was a double major, and you can't be a double major and do honors. And then I realized there was this 8-credit-hour course in psychopathology. And I said, well, is there anything that says I can't take both? Like, I took one, can I now take the other? Uh-huh. And we don't have a rule against that, but nobody's ever asked to do it. And I was like, well, there's no rule against it. I guess I can do it. So uh-huh. I got away to taking 12 hours worth of psychopathology as an undergrad.
Uh-huh.
And so I got it in both courses, but was really able to delve deep in that second course. And then in my socianth major, we were required to do a senior thesis. That was what I decided I wanted to look into to a greater degree in that thesis. So my thesis was on eating disorders, but it was sort of something that I stumbled across more from an intellectual interest. I realize for a lot of people, it's predominantly because you have a friend or something like that. But there were just so many things that dovetailed in eating disorders that sort of captured my interest, that's sort of how I started focusing.
Well, if you were interested in women, in biology, psychology, your sociology, anthropology, here you are. I mean, as you say, that the intersection of all those fields is certainly captured in the world of eating disorders. So when you applied to graduate school, where did you...
I applied to work to go into eating disorders. So the people I applied to work with were all in eating disorders.
So tell me about that. Where did you wind up going, and what was your area of focus as you started?
So I, like many people, we still tell people that I was told very, very hard to get into all of that type of thing. So wasn't sure if I would get in, applied to, I don't remember how many programs, and applied to work with Terry Wilson at Rutgers University. That was the only school I got into. For all of those of you who are watching this, who are interested in going on in clinical psychology and might get discouraging news, you might find it helpful to know that I was told by one particular school, I will not name it, but the letter of rejection was captured by somebody who read it and said, in other words, this letter says you're not good enough. Even if you were better, you still wouldn't be good enough. But don't worry, there must be something that you can do, although it clearly is not going to be clinical psychology. So I was utterly and thoroughly rejected by many, many places. But lucky enough to get into one program with a fabulous mentor who you know, which was Terry Wilson, which set me on the road to doing exactly what I wanted to do, which was studying eating disorders.
Fabulous. First study that you did with Terry at Rutgers?
Probably my master's. So Terry was just coming back from Stanford, and where he had been at the Center for Advanced Study. So things were sort of slowly ramping up. So we did a study looking at the utility of the EDEQ in substance using population. So that was where I started. But the other thing that I was able to get out of Rutgers, which a longstanding interest of mine has been the research practice gap. So even as an undergraduate, I was really sort of flummoxed by the idea that people in clinical practice didn't use research and that researchers weren't listening to clinicians about what the problem was. And I was sort of like, this doesn't make any sense to me. So from a very early age within my career, I was sort of interested in that intersection. So even if my actual research wasn't around that with Terry, Rutgers was a great program to be studying and learning about that. And certainly Terry was one of the leading thinkers in that area. I think the other great thing I got from Rutgers was just outstanding clinical training. People tend to think of Terry Wilson as a great researcher. And what they don't realize was he was a fabulous clinician and one of the most meticulous clinical supervisors you could ever encounter.
I have to say, I just want to put an exclamation point after your comment there, because he also was one of my very first supervisors when I was at Columbia as a fellow. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. He was an extraordinary supervisor, really brilliant. So you're working with Terry, gaining an understanding of research, benefiting from his clinical supervision, and you've got to develop a dissertation and a particular area of focus for your own line of work. How does that get refined for you, and where do you wind up going with your...
I end up doing a study that I never even published. I'm the role model for everybody who's thinking like, if my dissertation isn't like the greatest thing ever, I failed, or if you've got to get into multiple programs or you failed. Like, I'm just going to model. You know what, you can mess up in all these areas and it doesn't matter. Terry was very interesting in that he was very much of the attitude that a best dissertation was a done dissertation,
right?
Had purchased some software to look at that you could study cognitive biases in variety of psychopathology. And he sort of had this software and he gave it to me and said, figure out how to use the software. And I was like, all right, I'll figure out how to use the software. So I figured out how to use the software. So that sort of made sense to just do my dissertation around it. So it ended up being a, sort of Stroop test, attentional biases, looking at, different types of cognitive biases that might be associated more with depressive type of symptomatology or anxiety based symptomatology. I found it interesting to do. It was kind of a jigsaw puzzle, and in the middle of it, it was interesting enough. But as soon as I was done, I was like, I'm done with that. That's not where my research is going to go. I also, when I was at Rutgers, observed that everybody who seemed to be doing really well had a couple of areas. They didn't just have one area. They had a couple areas. Jerry had substance use disorders as well as alcohol. Ray Rosen was a close supervisor, a mentor of mine as well. At Rutgers, the students used to joke that Ray did everything that might be bed related: sleep, cardiovascular disorders, sex. So I also went out of my way to get some background in anxiety-based disorders. And that really begins what gets observed across my career, which is I just sort of zigzag across different areas. So I have a lot of colleagues here at Trinity that their research focuses very much I have a colleague who's a developmental psychologist and she studies verb learning in young children. And that is what she does. I always joke with my students, I'm a little bit more like, oh, there's a shiny thing over there. Oh, that's interesting over there. Oh, what's over there? So I sort of ricochet around a lot more and then bring things together based on those diverse experiences.
So one of the areas that I know has been an interest of yours and I guess was a shiny bauble at some point that you brought into your studies in an integrated way is around eating disorders in athletes. Can you tell us some about that work and how that has evolved for you and shaped what you're doing today?
Yeah, so we're still doing, along with my colleague, Dr. Tiffany Stewart at Pennington Biomedical Research Center, still doing work with female athletes. That really emerged. So I was doing eating disorders prevention, though I later preferred to describe it as, you know, risk factor reduction, that we were trying to reduce risk factors for eating disorder pathology in collegiate, and I know the work was extended by other people into high school girls, so collegiate women and high school girls. Mm-hmm. Clinically, I was having conversations with our athletics department. So one of the great advantages of being at a small school, one of the things I love about being at a liberal arts college professor is that the people I get to know are not largely in psychology. You know, my closest friends have been in chemistry and anthropology and engineering. And so I was interacting down with athletics sort of clinically. And they said to me, when you're done helping us get protocols for athletes with eating disorders in place, you know, you're doing all of that, you know, body project type work, though we called it something different at the time. And they're like, we would like something for our athletes. Mm-hmm. They invited me to go ahead and develop something. And I thought, well, that's a cool idea. Okay, so let's try and develop something. And so we compared two interventions. I'm not a big sort of invent the wheel all over again. I have a tendency to assume that somebody's at least got a rough outline of a wheel that I should try in a different circumstance. And so I looked at two interventions that had been developed by Eric Stice and said, well, let's modify these based on what I understand about the lives and experiences and body image of athletes. Female athletes in particular have been identified as having two different body images. So one that is related to their sport, sort of their athlete body image, and then one that is related to just being a woman, for instance. Mm-hmm. So the body image that is salient when they're performing in their sport is not going to be say, the same body image that say is salient when they're going out to a party on a Saturday night. Very different. So modified the interventions, got a small grant, R15, which is a small grant you can get when you're at a liberal arts college, to look at two interventions, got some nice pilot data, and came up with an idea for a bigger study. One of the downsides of being at a small college with a high teaching load is that you can't run a big multi-site randomized control trial on your own because there's a limit to how many courses you can buy out. Trinity students come to Trinity to be taught by Trinity faculty, not by adjuncts or teaching assistants. And so ultimately I partnered with Tiffany Stewart and we, took the pilot data and turned it into the Female Athlete Body Project, and did a large randomized controlled trial. I was somewhat disappointed in the results compared to that which we had gotten with non-athletes. But I had a couple great consultants on the trial, one of whom was Ron Thompson, who I think of as sort of the grandfather of, Eating Disorders in Athletes, with Roberta Sherman being the grandmother. And then Jerry Wilson was also a consultant on that trial, both of whom kept telling me, Carolyn, you got better results than anybody's gotten with female athletes before. So you should be happy with that.
So Carolyn, tell me the basic principles of the Body Project and then how you have adapted it specifically for athletes.
Okay, so the Body Project, the traditional Body Project run in non-athletic populations, is a cognitive dissonance-based intervention that, as I mentioned earlier, was developed originally by Eric Stice. So the idea here is that internalization of Western appearance ideals is a risk factor for the development of body dissatisfaction, which in turn is a risk factor for the development of dietary restraint and negative affect, both of which in turn are more proximal risk factors for the development of eating disorders. Right. So the idea, the rationale was that if you could decrease investment in the appearance ideal, you would theoretically be causing a cascading effect that could ultimately prevent some eating disorders. I have moved away, though, from thinking about the Body Project predominantly as an eating disorders prevention intervention, because the number of people out there who suffer from body dissatisfaction is far greater than the number that will ever go on to develop an eating disorders. So I think that reducing body dissatisfaction is a noble aim in of itself. Body dissatisfaction is also a potent risk factor for the development of suicidal ideation, major depression, decreased investment in health behavior. So it has all sorts of negative, other negative effects. The fact that we can reduce the onset of some eating disorders by reducing body dissatisfaction is great. I think that's wonderful, and I'm really glad we can do that. And it's really important, but I think also just reducing body dissatisfaction in and of itself and sub-threshold eating problems and all of that is really important. So the Body Project does this by basically having a series of activities where we encourage participants to speak and act against the Western appearance ideal. So we all know why we want to conform to the Western appearance ideal. Media, the people around us tell us wonderful things will happen. The light will shine, you know, the golden carpet will be rolled in front of us if we can only achieve these ideals. But we don't spend a lot of time talking about the costs of pursuing that. And so what the Body Project does is, through a series of exercises, is really invites people to explore and all the negative aspects of pursuing this appearance ideal and to speak and act against it, thus inducing the uncomfortable psychological state that we refer to as cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. And what decades of cognitive dissonance research shows is that when we sort of act in this behaviorally hypocritical way, on the one hand, I believe in the appearance ideal, on the other hand, I speak and act against it, most typically I will align my beliefs in line with my behavior. So I will decrease my investment in the appearance ideal and therefore create that positive cascade that I talked about. Now, with athletes, going back to the point we were talking about before, there are a couple of challenges. First, as I mentioned before, you've got two body images, not one. And the Western appearance ideal and the sport ideal are somewhat different. So for instance, the Western appearance ideal for women is large breasts. In most athletes, it's a flat chest. And then athletes, though, might want to have both depending on the situation that they are in, or feel pressure to conform differently depending on the situation they're in. But nonetheless, body image is more complicated in athletes. So the very first thing you have to do is you have to acknowledge not one appearance ideal, but two appearance ideals. In addition, you have to deal with the fact that the sport-specific appearance ideal varies according to sport. So the tennis ideal looks different than the cross country ideal, which looks different than the swimmer ideal. Mm-hmm. So you have to address this issue. Are we going to run the intervention within a sport? Are we going to go across sport? In which case we've got to raise the different ideals. Another confound is that athletes are very interested in performance. So they weren't necessarily all that excited about taking a intervention or participating in an intervention that was going to make them feel better about their bodies. They wanted something that was going to enhance their performance. So we know more information about nutrition into that intervention. The other challenges that we discovered is that some athletes, and this may be their competitive nature, when pushed into that state of cognitive dissonance, becomes somewhat aggressive. We never saw that in our, we never even saw that in athletes who were participating in our studies, where their athletic identity was not salient. Uh-huh. But when their athletic identity was salient, if they felt that the cognitive dissonance was challenging them in a way that might impact their performance, they sort of became somewhat angry. So we actually had to
dial defensive of their
internalization. So we had to dial down the dissonance somewhat.
Interesting.
Particularly because we were running it with peers. Peer leaders were running it. So.
So you mentioned you have lots of interests and you have worked with a range of individuals and demographics who have different demographics. We've talked about your athletes. You've also worked in other areas that the field of eating disorders wasn't paying attention to, that really got you to one. You have many big ideas, but the one that you're going to share with us today around zeroing in on groups that were otherwise assumed not to be at risk. Tell us how you got there and who are these folks and how are they at risk for eating disorders?
Right. So you're talking about the research that we've done with very low income individuals who are food insecure. And for those people who are not familiar with the term food insecurity, that's basically referring to people who do not have the resources, typically financial resources, to adequately secure safe, and nutritious and appropriate quantities of food. So these are individuals who cannot adequately access the food that they need in order to live a healthy, active lifestyle. And as you said, this was a population that the eating disorders field really hadn't looked at. And it's kind of funny how we got into this research. People were, when we published our first paper, people were like, this was a brilliant idea. I'm like, it wasn't a brilliant idea. It sort of evolved again, kind of organically. So as I've mentioned numerous times on this, I'm a professor at a small liberal arts college. And this, of all things, came out of my teaching. So I was teaching a first year experience. If you come to Trinity University, you take a 6-credit hour, though I think it's probably going to get made bigger. But you get it at the time. You took a 6-credit hour course that was taught by 2 faculty, met 5 days a week. It was set up in little sections of 15 students. Optimally, at least 6 faculty would agree to teach on 1 syllabus and 1 day a week, all 3 sections of 15 students. So 45 students and 6 faculty would all come together for a common experience. The class I taught was called Food Matters. We jokingly said this is the only course at Trinity University that's a 4-letter word that can touch on almost every discipline in the entire, university. It didn't have anything about eating disorders in it. We started with industrial food and understanding what is modern industrial food and how it came to be. We looked at food production. We explored different types of diets that people are encouraged to have. We looked at sensory specific satiety. We looked at colonial production of sugar. We looked at food and slavery in the modern day times. This course wandered all over the place and was created by an interdisciplinary team of faculty. One of the areas that we spent quite a bit of time on was food justice and food insecurity. And that was spearheaded by my colleague and now research collaborator, Dr. Keisha Middlemass, who has since moved on to Howard University and is also at the Brookings Institute. And so it was in that class that I learned a lot about food insecurity. Keisha Middlemass and I loved teaching together, and we had some research interests around post-traumatic stress disorder that overlapped. And so we liked teaching together so much, we started, bantering around the idea of maybe doing research together someday, something interdisciplinary. We didn't really get any further than that. And then I had 2 students come to see me who said, hey, and these were students I knew really, really well, super bright students, both came to me independently and said, hey, Dr. Becker, I want to do research with you, but that body project stuff that you're doing with college students, I'm not at all interested in that. I want to work with marginalized communities here in the city of San Antonio. And I always joke that I do my best thinking when I'm walking my dogs in the morning. So I have high energy dogs. They get 3 miles of walks in the morning. And I'm just sort of juggling these things in my head, which is sort of, they don't want to do the body project. They want to work with minoritized communities in San Antonio. We've been thinking about doing work with Keisha, the food insecurity piece. And, you know, these are just sort of tumbling around in my head. And suddenly I went, wait a minute. Food insecurity, by definition, they're going through periods of dietary restriction. They're not necessarily going through periods of dietary restriction because of weight and shape concerns, which is what we typically focus on in the eating disorder field, and which I've been focusing on extensively through the Body Project. They have dietary restraint for financial reasons, but we've known since the 1940s in Ansel Keys's work with the Minnesota Starvation Study, that dietary restraint for reasons other than weight and shape concerns, in that case, they were starving for science, can produce eating disorder symptoms. And so I was suddenly thinking, I'm like, they should be binge eating. And then I started thinking about research I had seen presented probably at the Eating Disorder Research Society meeting by Mary Boggiano and the work that they were doing with rats and how you could have rats on normal amounts of rat chow and they're all living their normal rat lives and they're genetically identical and nothing interesting is happening. And then you add Oreos into the mix. Oreos, of course, would be what we consider a highly palatable food or hyper-processed food, I think is how they're referring to it these days. And we spend a lot of time talking about those types of foods that our field doesn't really always pay that much attention to, which I think is a mistake because the food industry spends billions of dollars engineering those right. foods to override natural satiety mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So those foods induce binge eating in rats. And I think there's pretty compelling evidence because this is what they're engineered for. They also induce overeating in human beings. And the thing we know about people living with food insecurity is not only are they experiencing dietary restraint, not only do they live in food deserts, and i.e. places where they don't have good access to nutritious food and good access to grocery stores, they live in what we refer to as food swamps. And a food swamp is one where highly palatable food predominates. So I'm thinking
more highly processed food, as you described.
Right, so. Highly processed food right. is really going to dominate. So I'm thinking we've got dual pressures for binge eating.
Right.
Restriction for financial reasons, and we've got an overabundance of this highly engineered food that messes with satiety.
Mm-hmm.
It equals binge eating. So I went to my colleague, Dr. Middlemass, and said, what do you think? And she looked at me like I had two heads and said, you're nuts. Eating disorders are a rich white girl's problem. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you think poor people, particularly poor people in San Antonio, where inevitably they're going to be predominantly Hispanic. San Antonio is one of the first cities to go minority white. So we knew our sample would be highly Hispanic Latino. And I went to the students and they were like, well, that's kind of an interesting thought. Wouldn't have thought that. And I said, well, go do a literature search. So they did a literature search and we basically could find almost nothing. We found one question in one study by one researcher and we found, I don't think it was even published at the time. I think there was a dissertation that we eventually found, but it was never published. And so we decided to do the first study looking at eating disorder pathology in people living with food insecurity. And when we were done collecting, and we partnered with the San Antonio Food Bank, shout out to the San Antonio Food Bank who have been our partners now on three studies. What we found was that as food insecurity increased, every indicator of eating disorder pathology, but also anxiety, weight stigma, everything got worse, such that those with the highest level of food insecurity, which basically using the measure we did or what we would call a child hunger household group. So these were adults filling out the questionnaires, but they were reporting that they had hungry children at home. And the general presumption in the food insecurity world is that if you have hungry children at home, the adults are even more hungry because most adults will prioritize restricting their own intake to feed children. So if the children are hungry, the adults are even more hungry. And what we saw were very elevated rates of eating disorder pathology. So for instance, 17% of the people in this child hunger household group appeared to meet criteria for a clinically significant eating disorder, which is vastly higher than we would see in any other community sample.
So tell us, what does the eating disturbance look like?
So the surprising part was it wasn't only binge eating. So we saw high levels of binge eating. We saw high levels of night eating. So people going to bed, waking up, eating with distress. Which we expected. We saw somewhat elevated rates of dietary restraint. And in a subsequent study, people reported they were predominantly restricting for financial reasons, or in the case of this group, to stretch food for children. We did see elevated weight and shape concerns, which in retrospect makes sense. Poverty is not going to be protective against general societal messages that higher weight bodies are bad. Those messages are endemic in our society. Much to my surprise, we also saw elevated rates of vomiting. And we've replicated that in subsequent studies.
You're seeing elevated rates of binge eating. You're also seeing elevated rates of vomiting. And are you seeing elevated rates of body dissatisfaction and body dissatisfaction driving the disturbance?
That's where things get complicated. So we do see elevated rates of body dissatisfaction, but in qualitative analyses, we do not see them reporting that is the primary driver of restriction. The primary driver of restriction appears to be financial, but there are weight and shape concerns. And more recent qualitative data from another group had people reporting that when they lost weight due to financial reasons, they considered that an added bonus. Mm-hmm. So it's not maybe that the weight and shape is the driver concerns, but it is there. So again, poverty doesn't make you immune to societal messages that big bodies are bad, but mm-hmm. it is not the primary driver of the restriction, is what we think is going on. The vomiting is complicated and we don't fully know. I think we need a whole lot more qualitative research in this area to really understand what is going on. But since that work has come out, we've heard anecdotal evidence of people saying that they just so thoroughly lost control of their eating that they vomited out of discomfort. Mm-hmm. Again, suspect this is, I'm totally hypothesizing here, that for some people, just like it does in eating disorders that are started for other reasons, it may take on an emotion regulation type of component. Because we know that these individuals are, you know, the people who we're looking at who are high in eating disorder pathology are also high in anxiety and high in depression, high in weight stigma. They're high in many things. So it sort of becomes, you know, a constellation and may take on a life of its own.
So Carolyn, you've worked with a range of segments of our population. This latest group focused on a financially poor demographic and looking at food insecurity, you see significant eating disturbances and surprise the field in a certain way to say, hey, guys, eating disorders are much more widespread. Here's another segment of our population that is suffering. What's your, you know, sort of your big picture, big idea takeaway that you want to make sure the next generation of clinicians and researchers bring forward?
We have to dismantle the eating disorder stereotype. So to me, that's the biggest issue, is we have had this stereotype that eating disorders are first and foremost a problem for at least reasonably affluent, relatively thin, white women and girls who are relatively young. Mm-hmm. And that is where a bulk of our research has focused. And when I started doing this work, Dr. Keisha Middlemass wasn't the only person who looked at me like I had two heads. I remember being when EDRS and the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies conferences overlapped, and I was telling people I was collecting this data, everybody looked at me like I had two heads. And it didn't matter if they were a grassroots activist or a senior researcher, everybody was like, you've lost your mind collecting this data. Like, and I think it was because this group so thoroughly violated the stereotype in every single possible way. But that stereotype has boxed us in. That stereotype is the reason that people don't think of eating disorders as a public health problem. I have a relative who works in oncology. And that relative was explaining to me how, you know, you could create the cure for ovarian cancer. And even though ovarian cancer is an incredibly devastating illness with a high mortality rate, and it would be wonderful to cure ovarian cancer, ovarian cancer hits relatively few people relative to many other cancers. And what struck me and when I learned about that was, it's like we made ovarian cancer of eating disorders the poster child of eating disorders. Mm-hmm. We made anorexia nervosa the poster child of eating disorders in one small segment of people. And in doing so, and it's not just clinicians and researchers, though we know it affects clinicians and researchers, but it affects everybody. It affects who thinks they have an eating disorder. It affects when we talk to NIH about eating disorders in people with food insecurity, they say eating disorders don't exist in people with food insecurity. Obesity, now that's a problem in people with food insecurity. You know, even though we have the data now, that stereotype prevents the funders, the larger medical community, the population of people who suffer from eating disorders, the loved ones of people who suffer from eating disorders, clinicians, including clinicians who treat eating disorders, everybody ends up with blinders on, and we are missing so many people with eating disorders. And then we lose the ability to show what I think is truly the case, which is that eating disorders are a major public health problem.
Couldn't agree with you more, really. And I think what you're saying also is that, you know, our frameworks are really important. Our theoretical models are really important. Frameworks are really important to understand what we're seeing. They also constrain our capacity to see outside the framework.
Think about our measures, our dietary restraint measures.
Right.
We all say you're restricting because of weight and shape reasons, or more recently, weight and shape and control reasons.
Mm-hmm. It would be important to consider the questions we need to ask to understand, how is this group the same? How is it different? How does it add to our understanding of eating pathology? Because if, for example, it turns out that within this group that you've studied, when they move to an economic status of greater financial security and therefore greater food security, do the eating disordered symptoms resolve naturally, or are they retained? And then what was part of the etiology is no longer maintaining the disorder, but now you've got patterns of disordered eating and
self-maintaining
behaviors that are going to maintain things.
And I think we know that that happens for at least some people. Mm-hmm. Because as this work has come out, more of our grassroots activists have said, oh yeah, by the way, I was food insecure as a child.
Right.
Now, and I see it. And as more clinical settings have started to look at this, they're like, oh yeah, we're finding people who both have food insecurity now, but had it in the past. Yeah. Undoubtedly, there are some people that when they become food secure, rotate out of it. And I think we would need to understand what's the difference between those who work their way out of it on their own and those who get stuck. But those are the questions we're going to have to ask. Those are the people we're going to have to listen to. And I think a big part of this is also going to be listening to our activists. We have a very vibrant expert by experience community in the eating disorders field. I know that sometimes that relationship gets bumpy, but I think we need to spend some real time listening to what they're telling us about their lived experience, including the people who are in higher weight bodies, who by definition defy the stereotype.
Your work has pushed the envelope, right? And you've gotten people thinking in different ways. A big piece of that, you mentioned being a professor at Trinity University, a liberal arts educational system where teaching is is the cornerstone of your work. You've been recognized, awarded the Z.T. Scott Faculty Fellowship Award for Excellence in Teaching, another award in 2017, named the Piper Professor by the Minnie Stevens Piper Foundation for Superior Teaching. clearly you care a lot about preparing the next generation and enabling them to take these questions forward and empowering them to do so. As you imagine the next 10 years of this field, one or two ideas that you want to share for those who are your students who will go on to be the leaders in the field?
I don't know that I want to constrain them. I think they're going to have great ideas all on their own. I think the main idea I would say is don't let anybody tell you how you're supposed to do it. If I think there's one great lesson that I had when I decided to become a professor at a liberal arts college, I can't tell you how many people told me that's a really silly idea. Don't do that. You belong at a certain type of institution. And if I look at my best work, whether it's the food insecurity work or the work that we did with the Body Project in terms of moving delivery of the intervention to peers, so task shifting it when developing a train the trainers model, all of that stuff, my best work hasn't been grant funded. My best work wasn't constrained. And it was heavily informed by the younger generation and by listening to my students. So I think the big idea I would have for them is don't let anybody tell you how it's supposed to be.
Well, you certainly modeled that and as a result have advanced the field, contributed dramatically to our understanding of eating disorders and what an eating disorder is and for whom an eating disorder is a risk. And so I want to thank you for joining me today and for the work
that you've done.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you.